As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello, everybody, and welcome once again to The View from the Lane. It is, as you're well aware, the multi-award-winning Tottenham Hotspur podcast from the mighty Athletic. Joining me, sometimes genial host Danny Kelly, are the Athletic's Jack Pitbrook and James Moore. And on today's episode, we're going to discuss Spurs against the low block, the opening goal of Timo Werner's Spurs career, super sub Brennan Johnson, and the fantastic spirit they showed against Crystal Palace. Much of so we'll cover mostly the game because there's so much to talk about, and a very famous game from the, well, 20-odd years ago, which the anniversary which falls on the day that we're recording this on the Monday. Okay, right, let's get straight into it. A little bit the same old story for Spurs in the first half, playing against the low block, struggling to turn a great deal of possession. And for much of the first half, it was over 80% into real threat. Oliver Glasner lied to me and played five at the back, not three, but five at the back. What did you make the way Spurs set up and went about dealing with it? What did you make of the first half, Jack?
So I thought at half time that it was too similar to the recent home games where they haven't played very well. So that would have been Wolves, Brentford and Brighton, all of which they went 1-0 down. Even though, obviously, firstly, Tottenham restricted Palace to no chances at all, really, in that first half. And Spurs had the best chance themselves, which was the Timo Werner one. But putting that Timo Werner, I mean, I'm sure we'll come back to that Timo Werner chance later. But in general play, I thought Tottenham found it difficult to get round Palace's back five. I also detected quite a lot of frustration, I think, from the home crowd. At the sort of Spurs being maybe a little bit ponderous in possession. And their reluctance to shoot, which I thought felt quite noticeable. That all said, I mean, what interested me after the game was I was expecting Postecoglou to come in and say what he said a lot recently, which was the first half wasn't good enough, and then fortunately we managed to turn it around in the second half. But in fact, he was pretty happy with the first half performance, which just goes to show that sometimes, you know, you can sit in your seat and end up with a sort of different analysis of the game than the manager has.
I mean, I would agree with what Jack says. It felt very similar to those other games. Different to Brentford and Brighton and Wolves in that. Actually, they were 1-0 down in all three of those, weren't they? So different to those in that they hadn't gone behind. I mean, I would say Brentford and Brighton could walk away from that stadium having lost and think, been a little bit hard done to here. I know we talked about the numbers after the Brighton game and you know, I kind of suggested they hadn't been unlucky, and that's probably about right. But if they'd drawn, it wouldn't have been a massive injustice. I don't think we could be complaining about that. This game, the Palace barely had a sniff, really. And I think that's probably the root of Postecoglou's satisfaction, in that for the first time in a while, Spurs had a form of control over a game. Even if it was, like, for the most part, quite sort of sterile domination, they did basically dominate the game in terms of possession and the chances created, even though there weren't that many. Like, in percentage terms, you know, the percentage of good chances in the first half, did Spurs have 100%? They probably did.
Yeah, and you know, we were talking obviously last week about how Spurs' XG against and how high it's been this season, and to what extent is it a blip or is it kind of something inherently wrong with Ange Ball? But yes, I mean, on Saturday, sorry, it was the lowest it's been all season. You know, I think their XG against was 0.32. And obviously, like, for context, the goal that Palace scored was a free kick and probably not high on XG. And obviously they had quite a few chances which were in fact offside. And so in the moment it feels like a big chance, though obviously in hindsight it doesn't count on this metric. But the fact that it should be so low, in fact it's almost just over half of the previous lowest of the season, which was also against Crystal Palace, you know, the Crystal Palace away game, 0.61. That does tell us that, or it does suggest, I think, that A, the defence is probably heading in the right direction in terms of their ability to control games now that Van der Ven and Romero are back. And also, you know, in the bigger picture, that Ange Ball can be defensively secure, or at least defensively secure in games like this. I mean, against a team who didn't really show a lot of attacking ambition. But I think this is one of the reasons that Postecoglou was happy afterwards, was that sense of control and Palace never really having a sniff.
Okay, listen, the game might have been very, very different if Timo Werner had converted his great chance after 18 minutes. It's almost become a cliche about him. If he's got any time to think about it at all, he doesn't convert the chance.
Yeah, I just thought you could really tell his lack of confidence in front of goal because of his method for taking the chance, which was basically to keep running and running and running, delay the moment at which he'd have to take the shot, try and take the ball all the way around Sam Johnston until he gets an open net. And then obviously, you know, he takes it wide and then he gets the shot off eventually and Johnston saves it. Whereas it was like he took the shot on like 2 or 3 seconds too late. The number of times we've seen Son do this, and we've got the perfect example because Son scored a goal like this in the second half. Like, Son always takes that shot kind of before the keeper's expecting him to, when he's around the edge of the box. I think the one Son's goal on Saturday was from just outside the edge of the box, and I'm sure Son would have taken that shot on really early. But Werner clearly, I think he doesn't have, he's barely, I think his last open play goal was in, before Saturday, sorry, was in September for Leipzig, and he just doesn't have the confidence to take it on early. So in that sense, you sort of feel for him a bit, because it was almost like he wasn't enjoying being in that situation.
I have to say, watching it back on Saturday night, I think it was slightly better goalkeeping than it felt in the moment. I mean, I'm not suggesting he shouldn't have scored, and if he signed Timo Werner online or otherwise, and he gets an opportunity like that, that is kind of the kind of opportunity you're expecting him to score, I'd say. But I don't think he completely messed it up. But this isn't like a thing where it should be like on his blooper reel, like some of the other stuff we've seen from him before at Chelsea. But look, I mean, it's another thing where, is if you put that in a different context, if he had scored, you know, if he was a player who had scored a dozen goals this season and then missed that opportunity and then scored in the second half, you probably wouldn't even come, we wouldn't be talking about it. And I know you have to have that context, it is important. But I don't know, I think the goalkeeper's like stood him up long enough and then like extended incredibly, you know, he's really extended to like get his both hands to that shot.
His penultimate touch takes the ball back underneath his body, and Son just never ever allows that to happen. It's always in front and to one side of him. A, that gives the defender more of a problem, and well done to Richards for not bringing him down, by the way. There are many more experienced and seasoned defenders would have taken the red card. So half time, it's 0-0. Second half, Spurs were much better. And they were much better throughout the second half, I thought. They were dynamic. They got on the front foot. All those cliches. And so we all have watched enough football over the years to know that, of course, that meant Palace were going to score. and they duly did. Interesting goal in one way, in that Bentancur, who was picked ahead of Saar for the game, and I'm sure you'd have your thoughts about that, James, loses the ball in a midfield tussle, chases the ball all the way back to the edge of the box, commits the foul, gets the yellow card. They score from equalizer, and he's hooked within a few minutes. That could have been a planned thing for a player who's not fully fit after an hour, or it could be that the manager was less than thrilled with that sequence of events.
Football cliches. I think it was a bit of both. I mean, obviously Johnson's come on, and then that's kind of a substitution that's turned the game. I mean, you're right, Danny. Spurs did improve in an attacking sense in that kind of first 15, 20 minutes of the second half. You know, Son had that shot that looked like it was going in the hit of post and whatever else. I can't even remember the penalty was before, or the penalty shout, sorry, which I'm sure you want to talk about, Danny. Was that before or after the free kick? Was it after?
Let me consult my notes. The Munoz foul on Timo Werner was before the free kick.
I mean, that I don't know if you want to get too sidetracked by that, but that was obviously a penalty. And I know, Danny, you have this theory on number of touches in the box being incredibly high and number of penalties being
Are now becoming bewildering. I mean, but it's really difficult, isn't it? Because I thought Werner moved his foot towards the contact, to be truthful.
Well, he moved his foot towards the ball, right? I mean, I don't know.
A foul.
But yeah, I mean, look, Benteke, he didn't have a great game, I don't think. Or certainly by his standards. I mean, I don't think he was exceptionally bad, but clearly in that moment he was. And you know, that, look, the other thing we have to say is, having bemoaned not having any or very few senior players on the bench, well, A, that, and B, a manager who doesn't necessarily kind of change a system too much. I mean, I think you kind of have to say that change does kind of signify the fact that you could change it from the bench in both senses. And obviously it worked.
Anybody want to criticise Vicario for the goal?
I did wonder, is he standing too central?
I think there was an element of confusion over the Palace building a second wall beside Spurs' wall, like sort of jealous neighbours when you build a gazebo and they have to have one exactly the same. But I didn't blame him for it. It was a great finish by Eze and that was all of it, you know. But I saw one or two football men getting stuck into the Spurs goalkeeper there.
It looked to me like he was clearly expecting the ball to go over the wall, right? So he was expecting to dive to his right and I don't really know what I'm talking about when it comes to the technical aspects of goalkeeping, Danny, but it looked to me like he was ready to dive to his right with the ball going over the wall and was just not set to dive to his left, which was obvious. And Eze was smart enough to realise that if he put the ball where Vicario wasn't expecting it, he could kind of wrong foot him.
I think the purpose of Palace's wall was to delay sight of it.
Yeah.
Because if you look at them, they right. run, as he's coming at the ball, they split. And so he's got a flurry of bodies in front of him. And of course, you know, that ball takes, I suppose, a third of a second to get from Eze's foot into the back of the net. And if a quarter of that third of a second you can't see it, that's the whole thing done, isn't it?
There was a piece on The Athletic last week by our Palace correspondent, Matt Woosnam, which was about what Glasner had done with corners in his first game against Burnley. And the fact that he changed quite a lot. And supposedly, seemingly, from the comments under the piece, Hodgson wasn't particularly inventive with what they were doing from set pieces, and it made them incredibly predictable and easy to defend against. So I wonder whether this is another sort of Glasner thing that they've been doing loads in training this week and it's come off.
Let's look at the second half when we come back after the break. But Spurs' fantastic comeback, about which I want to talk in a wider context in just a second. You're listening to The View from the Lane with me, Danny Kelly, Jack Pitbrook and James Moore.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the team's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham, all new, Thursdays on FX, stream on Hulu. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Welcome back, everybody, to The View from the Lane. I'm Danny Kelly. With me are Jack Pitbrook and James Moore. A little bit of nostalgia, like I like to do at this stage. On this very day that we're recording this in 2007, I'd love to get your memories of this, particularly James. West Ham 3, Spurs 4, one of the most amazing games in Spurs' many 4-3 victories over the years in the Premier League. They were 3-2 down as we headed into the last seconds of the game and won 4-3 with that I think Paul Stalteri's only goal for Spurs.
I think he might have got another one against Man City the season before, okay. Maybe.
Thank you for that. I've got a nice little memory of this, which I'll give you first. And that is, I wasn't at the game. I was driving home through England from Ireland. I must have been to a family event, because what I can remember is I had two brothers and one sister in the car with me. So four of us listening on the radio. All of them Arsenal fanatics. I think we were challenging sort of around fourth and fifth, and Arsenal were fourth and fifth. So there was something in the game for them. But when Bobby Zamora scored to put West Ham 3-2 up with a couple of minutes to go, they were just, they could hardly contain their excitement. And of course, because they know that I can be quite explosive if I get going, it was in the form of snickering. I could hear a lot of snickering. I'm driving these buggers home and I can hear a lot of snickering. When the equaliser went in, there was a kind of deflation of the snickerers. But then when the winning goal went in, and of course, I can't really punch the air. I'm driving in on motorway on the M4, no doubt. Just the deflation of the Arsenal glitterati around me. Very, very lovely memory. One wants to have only the most pleasant memories of your direct family. But that was when I loved them all, getting a bit of deflation and the air taken out of the tyres. You'd have been a youngster, James. What do you remember about that game?
So I watched this game on TV and I remember getting that this was my kind of peak, getting incredibly agitated watching Spurs on TV. I'm quite placid now, but back then I used to get incredibly annoyed.
Wow.
And West Ham, I'm pretty sure West Ham bottom of the league. They're definitely kind of in the relegation mix.
They and were. Think... And Gary Neville, whoever was the co-commentator, I'm not sure it was Gary, no, whoever it was.
It can't have been Gary Neville.
No, he's too early. Was saying, and that's them down now. And yeah, they survived, right, didn't they? They had the miracle survival.
There was definitely a sense. I mean, I think that they were kind of, I don't know if it was like as many as 10, but they were a distance away from safety at that point. And I presumably, if it's a similar point of the year, it must have been about 10 games left.
Yeah.
And they looked pretty much done. Sadly, they stayed up. But
Tevez saved them, didn't he? Yeah.
Yeah. But this is the context of this, was the previous season where Spurs went to West Ham on the last day and lost and missed out on Champions League. So in the moment, it feeling like Spurs had won at Upton Park and sent West Ham down. It felt like pretty sweet revenge.
Yeah.
I mean, they still sing about that lasagna thing, don't they? Which is mad, given Spurs have like played in the Champions League loads of times, including in the final. It seems weird to still obsess over that, given they've been relegated twice since then as well. Or maybe only once, actually.
Well, I guess if you're not... how can I put this without being insulting? No, let's just be insulting. If you're not one of the bigger clubs, that is what your life gets reduced to now, doesn't it? You put a stick in a spoke of a bigger club once in a while. I mean,
they would argue they're champions of Europe, so...
Sure. And they've won their trophy. I mean,
we'll come on to that, I'm sure, in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, but what they've done recently, have they won any awards at the London Football Awards?
I don't think so.
That was a comeback, of course. It is one of the 104 times that Spurs have come from behind in the Premier League to win. They are now second on that list. Manchester United have come to mind 106 times to win. It was the fifth time this season that Spurs have done it, which in any other season would be a remarkable achievement. And so how did they do it, Jack? How did they get from behind to ahead of Crystal Palace? And in the end, romped away with it.
Well, I think there was certainly an improvement in performance from the start of the second half. As you said, it didn't really feel like that because of the goal that they conceded. But they were creating better and better chances in those first few minutes of the second half, I think. It was more higher intensity. They were moving the ball quicker. They were winning the ball back better. So there was, you know, Werner should have had the penalty when he was fouled by Munoz. Son hit the post after, a quick turnover. I think Royale won the ball and then created this chance, which could well have scored from. And then they went, you know, then Palace scored at the other end, which was really just a counter-attack in the sense that the free kick was generated by Eze winning the ball and then running into the space and then Bentancur having to foul him, basically. And then, you know, a minute later, I think Johnson made a save for Werner, and then Brennan Johnson comes on and nearly scores a goal that was not exactly the same, but similar to the kind of the winner against Brighton, but the ball goes over the bar. So Spurs were already on top at this point, and they were creating a lot more chances than they did in the first half. I think part of it comes down to the introduction of Johnson himself, who is becoming something of a super sub, who did really well to make that goal for Werner, not least because I think Joachim Andersen has the ball under not a lot of pressure, really, and then Johnson's got no right to win it, and then Johnson steals the ball from him and then runs through Andersen, through Jefferson Lerma, and then squares to Werner, making it basically a mirror image of his goal against Brentford, which was Werner from the left and then Johnson at the far post putting it in.
I mean, your piece makes the point that, and he won't probably be overly pleased with this, Brendan Johnson, that he had a long run in the first team when Spurs were struggling with numbers, and didn't look as effective as he has done coming off the bench. Now, this is a young player. He, you know, who knows what will happen. Kulusevski gets picked, even though I don't think he's having as good a season as he had last year, because of his work rate and his physicality and all those sorts of things. But against tiring defences, as you pointed out in your piece, in four games in recent times, he's had a real impact.
Yeah, he's been... I think he actually played too much earlier in the season. I think those 13 games in a row, I don't really think that would have been the plan when they signed him, but they kind of had to, really, because Kulusevski had to play in midfield because Maddison was injured. And then with Solomon and Perisic injured, Spurs needed the extra forward, having been a little bit short in there. This is obviously before Werner arrived. I think he played too much, and I think it probably affected his confidence a bit. He clearly didn't look on top, especially sharp in front of goal, and started to get a bit of grief from the fans. But I think the last few games, actually, funnily enough, it's since he dropped out of the team, he's actually started to look better and better when he came off the bench, paradoxically. This is three big substitute appearances in a row, Brighton, Brentford and Palace, where he's either scored a goal or set up a goal and been integral to a second half comeback, which has produced a win. So I'm not sure what the future is for him in terms of starting, or does he start in Kulusevski's position, or does he start in a different position? I genuinely don't know. But right now, I think this role is suiting him, and he's actually looking better than he has done at any point since he joined.
And I think it's always worth remembering that he's learned to play football in the era of 13, 14, 15, 16 players being involved in every game. If you start from the bench, I still take it as a great slight on a player not quite in the team, you know. But that's changed. The players themselves, I imagine, don't think like that, because they've come through a sport where being on substitute, being part of the matchday squad is itself what it's all about.
Just two things on Johnson. One, with some other players, we've kind of offered an injury as a sort of mitigation for subsequent underpar performances relative to the level. And I think Johnson's injury earlier in the season, sort of October, September time, is kind of the forgotten injury of the season. I think because it was around an international break, he only missed a couple of games. But that kind of came quite early and knocked him out of his rhythm. And then, you know, as Jack mentioned, he had that run of playing loads where clearly that wouldn't have been the plan to start off with. Secondly, for the third or fourth time on this podcast, if I can just wipe away all context as we know it from the start of the season to January or whatever. Like if he'd signed at the start of January, or he hadn't played too much in the first half of the season, or he'd been injured for the whole first half of the season or whatever, and had just played from the start of January and, you know, got his assist against Bournemouth. Actually, that was in December, but near enough. You know, goal against Brentford, goal against Brighton, and two assists on Saturday against Palace. A lot of those appearances from the bench. We'd be going crazy about how good he was, how good a signing it was, how high his ceiling was going to be. I think there's been a lot of criticism for Brendan Johnson, and you know, there's been some on here. I think we've been probably slightly more guarded about it than other places, from what I've kind of read and heard. But actually, when you look at it, he's had a decent first season. You kind of have to forget the transfer fee. I know that's difficult, particularly in the stage of FFP actually meaning something, and there always kind of being an argument that you could have signed someone else instead now. But I think he's done pretty well.
Oh, you know, and you know, the people who thrive on these kind of meaningless comparisons make the point that he's got as many assists this season now as Martin Odegaard. And so he gets the ball off a bizarrely careless Joachim Andersen. I don't know what Jefferson Lerma was trying to do, but you still have to win that tackle. Crosses the ball, and there, lo and behold, is Timo Werner. As you said, Jack, in a mirror image of the goal they created for each other a couple of weeks ago, to put the ball in the net. I was pleased for him. Not because you know, he's a lone player and you want him to do well and all the rest of it, but he deserved it. This is not a Maradona height bar, is it? But that was his best game for Spurs, I thought, Bernie, in terms of being in the team. You know, he seemed like part of the team.
Probably, yeah. I mean, that kind of spell against Brentford where he was just completely devastating for like 10 minutes would be the only comparison. But this, I guess, you would say, in terms of like consistency over the whole game, was a better performance. When Johnson scored that goal against Brighton, the late goal where he like attacked the back stick, timed his run, and you know we were praising him for how well he timed his run and whatever else, I said Timo Werner wouldn't score a goal like that because I hadn't seen him attack the back post like that at all. And clearly he would. He did.
What was interesting about what James is talking about specifically, which is the move where the low cross comes in and then the winger from the opposite side attacks the ball, is that early on the second half, there was a moment where Werner, again, from the left, flashed a low cross across the box. And it was the kind of thing where you would want somebody like Johnson popping up to attack the ball. But Kulusevski instead didn't make that run. He hung back, and then I think he received the ball on the edge of the... Like, he received the ball further away from goal and then eventually forced a corner. But you could see Postecoglou getting really annoyed about this because he obviously... He works in training to tell wingers to attack, you know, to attack that far post to try and score a goal. And then it was only a few minutes later that Johnson comes on, Kulusevski gets moved back into midfield, and in the post-match press conference, Postecoglou was talking about Johnson and his contribution, and he did say that there were moments where we were flashing the ball across the box and not really making that run, and it is, he said, it's not by accident, as in it's this is a specific movement that we work on training all the time, and I don't think it's unfair to call it the kind of like signature move or signature goal of Postecoglou's Tottenham, given how they want to play.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Victorinox, the makers of the original Swiss Army knife, have been a reliable companion for life's everyday challenges, mastering functionality, innovation, iconic design, and uncompromising quality with its products. The Victorinox Swiss Army knife provides you with all the things you don't think about until you need it. Tweezers, a screwdriver, and even a corkscrew. With the Victorinox Swiss Army Knife, you can be prepared to master everyday life. You can find Victorinox Swiss Army Knives at Dick's Sporting Goods.
A nice dink by James Maddison, who is very, very slowly recovering some of his form. And let's be honest, he has made a very stately start to his comeback from injury compared to where he left off before he came off against Chelsea. When the ball went in, I thought to myself, you know, the fast twitch fibre of my brain went, oh, there's a header by Richarlison, who wasn't even in the team, because that's the place where he gets that header. But Christian Romero was there, and hats off to him as well.
He definitely, like, when Spurs are chasing a goal, he definitely occupies more and more midfield positions, doesn't he? Both in possession or just running off the ball as a way to sort of destabilise the opposition in a slightly sort of John Stones type way, I guess. But it's effective, isn't it? If you've got someone who the opposition are not banking on coming into their penalty area, and then all of a sudden he's charging forward trying to win a header, then I can see that it would unsettle opposition defences a little bit.
Also, I mean, Son isn't bad in the air, but without Richarlison in the team, they've not really got that kind of physicality in the penalty area. So it's actually quite useful for him to kind of throw himself forward and kind of throw himself over defenders to get there first.
It's a fantastic moment. And afterwards, Christian Romero had lots to say about the game. I thought he was terrific, by the way. As was Van de Ven. Not under a great deal of pressure, but everything that Christian Romero did went well for him. But I just had a little thought that he was talking about his discipline. He said, it's something I've worked on. I've realised I've been picking up too many cards at some points here and there. Through working on it, you can try to eradicate certain things, maybe daft yellow cards for protesting too much or clashing with someone. With the style of defender I am, those clashes can be unavoidable sometimes if you have a face-off with someone. Now, I will tell you both, I had discussion this with our newish producer before we came on air. And perhaps because he's a generation younger than me, and perhaps he's just a more sunny disposition, he took what Christian had to say there, hook, line, and sinker. He's a reformed character, Christian Romero. He's the most clean and decent footballer in the Premier League. I have to say I took it with a rather larger pinch of sodium chloride, and I'll believe this when, you know, in 6 months' time, if he's still playing like he is and not getting booked and sent off, that'll be great. The test will come if Spurs go behind at Aston Villa, or the next time a South American, rather than the pest like Neil Mope, squares up to him. For some reason, he likes to get involved with his fellow South Americans. But the truth is, Jack, when I've finished taking the mickey out of him, he does appear to have calmed down slightly. And I guess the arrival of Van de Ven must have a huge part of that.
The impression I get from people who work at Spurs is that even inside the building, he's been very... like the ascension to the vice captaincy has brought out a different side of Romero. You know, takes more responsibility, more mature, more of a leader. In terms of discipline on the pitch this year, so obviously there was the red card. Has there been any flashpoints apart from the red card against Chelsea? I think it was just that one off, which was obviously bad, but it's, I think, the only real transgression I can remember from him this year. So maybe he has improved.
Just looking at his record this season as well, the other thing he's not done is get booked stupidly early in a game, which I think he did quite a lot in the first couple of seasons. Then he had kind of, you know, tiptoe his way around the rest of the game. But he's had 4 yellow cards in the Premier League this season. I mean, obviously he's had that red card as well that was in the first half of the game, which is quite bad. So he's not had that kind of tightrope walk that he's had in previous seasons.
And Postecoglou went to great lengths to praise him after the game, and he's just fantastic. When you talk about football matches for a living, you're always setting yourself up the next day as a calamitous game. But he's just fantastic centre half.
The thing we don't often say about him is that because he's so like aggressive and sometimes rash, too rash. He's a good footballer. He's not like some lump. I know this isn't really a surprise to anyone. I know I'm not telling anyone anything they don't know, but no one really ever talks about how good he is on the ball.
Jack pointed out that when Spurs are under pressure, he's the one who comes into midfield, yeah. and he has a range of passing. I mean, I'm not saying he's a Dan, but he knows how to tick the ball over, and he knows also sometimes to rake the ball wide to somebody else. He's just a very good footballer. Spurs got themselves well clipped with Son's goal, and I think there's a possibility, Jack, that we sometimes get blasé about Son when he breaks away from the last defender. Again, I find myself in a very optimistic mood about all that.
Yeah, it was just, I mean, everybody in the ground knew that he was going to score as he ran through. And, you know, the comparison between that chance and the Werner chance is obviously, we mentioned at the top of the show, it's there for all to see. I think the great thing about Son this season, I think the reason that I think people will draw so much heart from it, is that last season it really looked like the start of a decline. And it wasn't unreasonable to think that it was the start of a decline last season because, you know, attacking players who rely a lot on their athleticism don't stay at the top forever. You know, there comes a point where they lose their pace and then they're not really the same player. And there's tons of examples of this that we've seen. In fact, I think that what he's shown this season is that his bad form last year was actually, it was a blip, it was caused by injury, it was caused by, he clearly wasn't clicking well with Antonio Conte and the kind of coaching and the tactics. But now, it's basically back to classic Son. I genuinely didn't think this would happen. I didn't think we'd get back to classic Son, but we have done. And he's a joy to watch again.
By the end of the game, Spurs had made 728 passes for 78% possession. The passes was a record number. It does suggest a pretty dominant performance. And therefore, am I being churlish to say, will Postecoglou be thinking about that midfield again? Or will he say, you know, as he said, after the game, we played well throughout. If he looks at those passing stats, he'll say we had the ball massive amount of time and did a lot with it. I'm asking you this, Jack. James, because I think you were a bit disappointed that Saar wasn't picked.
Right. So, interestingly, of those 728 passes that you mentioned, 415 are in the first half, where, as we were saying before, I'm sure there were some sort of penetrative passes in there. Obviously, there was that amazing one from Son to Werner for that chance. But, you know, we mentioned sterile domination, and I think that's a pretty good way of describing it. I would imagine Ange Postecoglou, knowing him as we do by now, will not be impressed by huge numbers of passes. He's going to want the team to play far more quickly, far more incisively. I mean, I mentioned on the podcast last week that I felt Saar was the most important player in that midfield, purely on the basis of the kind of dynamism he shows with and without the ball. Really, his movement off the ball is really good, and he drives forward with the ball, without the ball. He'll attack the penalty area. We saw that against Brighton. That, I think, probably creates more problems for a team defending. I mean, obviously, if you can get like the best passers in the world and incredible runners, then you're going to cause problems. But in the meantime, you need people who are going to try different stuff. And I was really surprised that Saar didn't play. I mean, Bissouma, Bentancur and Maddison are all obviously brilliant players. I'm not suggesting any one of those is like an obvious weak link. But Saar is the one I think you really need in a game like that. Or probably really in any game, really, I think. I don't want to go quite as far as to say he's the most important player. But he just seems to be the one that in those games, we saw it in that Brighton game where they were really struggling with that man-to-man marking system that Brighton had come with. And he was the one who made that like surging run forward. And second time around, scored the goal, the equaliser. I was surprised by that. But, you know, I'm sure Postecoglou would again say his team won the game and his substitutions turned the game. So who am I to say it's wrong?
So Postecoglou said that I think Saar has a bit of a back issue, which they're having to manage. He didn't say that specifically why he didn't start, but he did say that it's kind of been on their mind since AFCON. I really hope he starts at Aston Villa, basically, because I think a game where there'll be a bit more space for him to attack into. I don't think Spurs can afford to have a midfield without someone making those runs. I think I completely agree with what James says. I think he's got more of a USP, inverted commas, than any of the other guys who can play in midfield because his off the ball movement is so good.
Isn't this fascinating? Because I wouldn't, when you were saying what you said about him last week, James, I wouldn't dare to contradict you too much because my own feeling is nebulous. But just for the sake of having all the views on the table here on the View from the Lane, I can probably sit here and reduce to a sentence what it is that Bentancur does, what it is that Bissouma is supposed to be doing, what it is that James Maddison does. And I find it much more difficult to be specific about what is Batasar is doing. And now, that's because I'm not a fully paid up clipboard holding football coach. I'm just somebody watching my own eyes. Nothing against the lad whatsoever. He has been, since he came back from his loan, he's been, you know, somewhere between fantastic and very fantastic most of the time. That running power is what he brings to the game. And I wasn't as shocked as you when he was left out.
Well, what I would say, the way I would describe it is, in general, it seems to me they play better when he's in the team than when he's not. And this is it's an easier thing to say now when Bentancur isn't playing well or as well. Like, if Bentancur was playing at his best, Bissouma was playing at his best, Maddison was playing at his best, then it's a complicated conversation. But to me at the moment, it feels like none of those three are quite at their best. You're probably going to put Maddison in a team purely for the goals. You know you need that. But the other two, I don't know, it feels like an obvious one to me.
Okay, well, listen, the upshot of all that was they got past a Crystal Palace team who, for a significant amount of time, despite Spurs' immense possession stats, you know, showed proper resilience. And as I said at the end of the last podcast, I thought this was a must-win game for Spurs, so I cannot complain. The Lambs are going to start appearing in the field soon and the sun is starting to make its presence known even here in the Republic of Ireland. And a really important win for Spurs. You're right. You know, the Villa game now looms extraordinarily large. And we'll talk about it on Thursday. And I suspect what we'll call it is a must-not-lose game. Although Villa's home record, despite a recent stumble, which they've now recovered from, is fantastic. But let's at least bask in that victory over Crystal Palace. Thank you both, James and Jack, for your contributions. Thank all of you for listening to us as well here on The View from Lane. Now, listen, I've got a bit of housekeeping to do here, and I want you to listen carefully. And we're asking you to fill in a quick survey about you and your podcast habits by going to theathletic.com/survey24. That's theathletic.com/survey24. Three lucky winners will get £100 worth of Amazon vouchers at the end of this. So whether you're a long-time listener or brand new, in which case, welcome as well, We want your feedback. Again, go to theathletic.com/survey24. And the link is also in our episode description. So thank you for that. It will really help us how we're going to do the podcast in future. But that is it for now from The View from the Lane. We'll be back on Thursday to preview what is now obviously a huge game against Aston Villa. A further reminder that the show has its own official home on X / Twitter at VFTL Podcast, or you can email us anytime you like at VFTL@theathletic.com. And for the best Spurs coverage anywhere, make sure that you sign up to The Athletic. Take advantage of our latest offer of just $1.99 a month for the next 12 months. Simply go to theathletic.com/SpursPod in order to subscribe. It's been a joy doing this. If you've had enjoyed it half as much as I have, then you've had an absolute blast. Bless you all. Next time.
The Athletic.